What would Yeshi do?
Produced by Yeshi Studio.
I'm Lindsay Kimura.
And I'm Edward Reeb. What Would Yeshi Do is a podcast dedicated to Yeshi Tsogyal, the mother of Tibetan Buddhism. Today, Lindsay and I sat down and interviewed Ian Baker.
Ian Baker is the author of The Tibetan Art of Healing, The Heart of the World, A Journey to Tibet's Lost Paradise, The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple, Buddhas of the Celestial Gallery.
As Richard Gere put it, Ian Baker's amazing journey is really a pilgrimage into our own true selves. Ian is currently working on a book called Tibetan Yoga. Tibetan Yoga is also the principal subject of an exhibition at London's Wellcome Collection, Tibet's Secret Temple, which Ian curated. And so, without further ado, let's get to that interview, shall we?
Let's do it. Hi, Ian.
Hi there. Happy to be here.
How did you first get interested in Tibetan healing, Tibetan Buddhism specifically? And how old were you?
I was actually 19 and I was in college and an opportunity arose. I was in a small liberal arts college in Vermont and which had a tradition in your junior year of going abroad. And of course, there was a wide range of the usual suspects, the usual options in Europe, etc. But there was also this extraordinary opportunity that appealed to me immediately and immensely, which was to go to Nepal. I was at that time a studio art major studying painting, and I was able to convince my advisor that going to Nepal would afford me the opportunity to study a traditional form of painting that was otherwise not, you know, available in the world currently. And to
is that the thangka?
That was thangka, literally, yes. So the Tibetan scrolls, and it's a tradition, obviously, that goes back centuries and centuries, if not millennia. And so that's I went under those auspices to apprentice in a project studying how to make Tibetan scroll paintings. And it was that which led me up to the to the Tibetan border in 1977, and studying with a traditional painter, sort of literally in the shadows of Mount Everest. And it was through him that I first learned about this Tibetan tradition of what's so-called hidden lands. And that came up in the context of learning to paint the Tibetan kind of landscapes that form the periphery and background for.
Is that pronounced Bayul?
Bayul, yes, literally. So bay means hidden or secret, and yul is land or country or valley. It can depending on context, but kind of the clearest translation is hidden land. And they were, as you said, bayul, places that were described first in Tibetan texts that date back to the 8th century and are considered to be places of heightened power and potentiality where particularly practices of meditation, yoga, etc., will be greatly accelerated. And simultaneously, they're places of just unique kind of, you could say, biodiversity. They all have sort of sacred herbs and plants associated with them. They're all invariably considered to be very hard to reach. All of that, you know, appealed to me immensely at the age of 19. So, because I was told immediately, you know, don't even think about trying to go to them because they're very, very difficult to reach. And so that was immediately an attractive, made them immediately attractive to me.
Wow. So these were places, if I recall correctly, Padmasambhava had shown Yeshi and after, or Yeshi Tsogyal. Do you know the pronunciation of that? Am I getting it right?
Yeah, no, Yeshi Tsogyal.
Tsogyal.
Oh, good. Yeah, Yeshi Tsogyal. Yeah, that was the Tibetan princess who became essentially, or Tibetan queen in that sense, the youngest queen who became Padmasambhava's consort and who is credited with having basically written down all his secret oral teachings, including the directions to these hidden lands.
Mm. So interesting. So you encountered some bees at one point in one of those Bayul.
Well, bees and many more things, but... But yeah, that's what makes them so fascinating because, you know, in a certain sense, they represent these kind of paradisical landscapes of the Himalayas, and certainly they fueled and fed the later kind of Western mythology, if you will, of the Himalayas in sense of Shangri-La as these kind of earthly paradises. But they are also, like any paradise, they've got snakes at the center,
right.
Just like our Western tradition. And and not only difficult to reach, but many hazards along the way. But that's what I sort of found so fascinating about the Tibetan accounts of these places, that it's these very hazards that become the spiritual path. It's how we encounter hardship, difficulty, and to some degree suffering that transforms experience and kind of brings us out of that sense of trying to negotiate staying in our comfort zones. And in a sense, the quest for the hidden lands is just the opposite. It's about willfully getting out of our comfort zones and encountering kind of a larger sense of reality.
Wow.
And Ian, did you have any obstacles that stood out to you or roadblocks in terms of your pursuits and your adventures, like getting started or along the journey? Mm-hmm. Things that you learned from, are there some that stood out that you could share?
Yeah, let's see. I mean, as I said, it was my first encounter with the hidden lands basically came when I asked a very even old at that time, although he just passed away last year at 102, an old Tibetan Lama who I knew was very, very versed in this tradition about, I asked for directions to go to one of these hidden lands. And he basically said to me, well, he responded with a very unusual question. He said, can you spend a month alone? And I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I said, of course, if that was something that was required, I would certainly do so. And he said, come back when you have a month alone, month to spare, and I will send you to a hidden land. And then you won't have to ask me what it is. You'll know for yourself.
Mm.
So that was, again, another one of those kind of challenges you can't refuse.
Yeah.
So I, back in those days, one had somehow more time available. So I went back in the summer when I did have time and presented myself, and he sent me with these two nomads to a very small little cave where I was meant to then stay for a month and come back and give him my account of the hidden land, because this was in one of these hidden lands. So that, in a certain sense, was the initial challenge, was my month alone in this small little cave in the middle of monsoon that was kind of perpetually wet and all kinds of things. But it stood out for me, I suppose, as an incredible, it was in a certain sense my back door into Buddhist practice, because it was something that I wouldn't have necessarily sought out to do on my own, and yet by doing it, it brought up so many things and issues that in moving through them, it sort of opened up a way forward, not only just to the study of these hidden lands, but just to life more generally, and certainly to spiritual practice. Now, I know that didn't answer your specific question.
No, that's fine. No, it's all good information. Yeah.
What kind of obstacles did I particularly remember? But I would just have to say that I wasn't planning, in my life and spending a month alone in a cave. And, I did feel a little bit more like Robinson Crusoe than a Buddhist, in a cave, in the sense that a lot of it was, very much survivalist, just getting enough water dripping from the cave walls to drink, mm-hmm. keeping the fire going in the monsoon, and, many, many obstacles in that respect. So it does stand out as that kind of initiatic sort of like threshold into this kind of ongoing project about hidden lands generally. So that was one. And then I would say certainly, the biggest one, which in a certain sense my book, The Heart of the World, is all about, was this quest for the door, as it's referred to, into the innermost secret of the most important of these hidden lands called Bayul Pimaka, the hidden land shaped like a lotus in southeastern Tibet. And the continual yearly attempts to get into this innermost part of what's now recognized in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's deepest gorge was an ongoing series of you could say edifying obstacles, in the sense that they were obstacles, but they were never they all had their absolute point, which is why I sort of referred to them as edifying, because they all led to a new approach that ultimately allowed us to reach this waterfall that conceals the door to the hidden, to the innermost part of the hidden land. And so the biggest obstacle, I would say, in that regard was basically following the traditional oral instructions for how to reach this spot, which were counterintuitive in the sense that we often had to head off in an entirely different direction to attain what is referred to in these texts as the key, and it's, you know, at a mountain that would ended up being a 3-week trek into the Tibetan wilderness. So it was, in a certain sense, leaving one's rational mind behind to enter into this kind of mythic narrative in which these hidden lands partake. So they were challenges, but they were also, in a certain sense, sort of delightful departures from life as we ordinarily know it, and entering into, you know, almost what can kind of characterize as a kind of dream time. Mm. And all kinds of, you know, amazing things happen, both in a certain sense, I wouldn't say good and bad, but things that are both challenging at the same time, you know, miraculous in some respects in terms of the kinds of coincidences that would happen along the way, both meteorologically, in terms of chance meetings, encounters, timings, all of those things just started to seem almost supranormal. And that's what really, you know, added, at least for me, in a, you know, whatever reason these things arose, it just, you did feel, or I felt certainly, and as did others who were with me, that we would sort of cross some kind of threshold of the way we expect reality to behave. That's all of a sudden it seemed to work on different terms. And that's really, in a certain sense, what has kept me in this, you know, fascinated with the phenomena of hidden lands, because they do seem to somehow function in a non-ordinary way.
It's incredible. And in terms of your background and upbringing, was your early life kind of accepting and open to doing this, or did you have to defy and challenge what people expected of you to go out and do something so extraordinary and different?
No, very good question. And in this sense, I was extremely fortunate, because my parents and family on both sides were immensely supportive of my eccentric adventures, in the sense that my mother, when she was in college, her mentor and very close personal advisor was Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist at, who, you know, was a professor at Sarah Lawrence University for many, many years. And so, you know, in a certain sense, my life in Asia and what I was doing there, she felt, was just a kind of enactment and of the kind of things that she'd been studying in college. So,
and
I could sort of live out. So I was very much brought up that way. On my parents were, you know, took me deep into the mountains when I was very young. It was nature was for both of them almost really a spiritual phenomena, and it and so I think they both certainly understood my deep passion for the Himalayan world and for climbing and you know, for all of the, you know, the cultural aspects that Nepal, in this case, which is where I first went, led me. And so I was in that sense very, very fortunate. And that extended to others, sort of extended family members as well. My grandparents had you know, taken me to the Alps when I was 13 and kind of basically when I was in the next year climbed the Matterhorn with their patronage. And so it was all always something deep within our family tradition of nature and exploration.
That's
so incredible. I was very lucky in that sense. I didn't have to explain myself. It was immediately understood.
You mentioned the how the totality of the experience includes both both good and bad, but not good and bad. It reminded me of what you were talking about your private conversation with the Dalai Lama and kind of the difference between how he speaks when he's speaking publicly with cameras rolling versus privately to a seeker. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind commenting on that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I mean, I've been very fortunate in that particularly early on, I was able to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama twice a year privately this is prior to his winning the Nobel Peace Prize, when he became, you know, his time became more and more in demand. And I was able to bring groups of American college students for audiences with him twice a year at his home in Dharamsala, India. So I always was able to arrange to have a private audience with him following those meetings. So this went on over several years. And so I was at that time, as I mentioned, seeing him twice a year and basically asking him for his his advice in terms of guiding me in terms of my own spiritual and meditative practices. And so, you know, it's not, I think, that there's so much a difference in the way he publicly presents himself and teaches versus privately. But what I found so extraordinary about him was his ability somehow to completely see, at least in my own case, what would be the most fruitful approach to Buddhist practice. So he introduced me, for example, which I write about in The Heart of the World, to a set of practices that, you know, from an external point of view can just seem almost outrageous, and yet which are a deep and very, very important part of the most esoteric of the Tibetan Buddhist teachings called
the Great... I think we just sold some books right there. With that one, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
All good. So, as I said, he did introduce me to this set of practices where he said, it sort of was the month thing. He said, you go off for a month to a place where no one will see you, because if they do, they'll think you're crazy.
So yeah.
Again, it's like, okay.
I did it at home, and my whole neighborhood thinks I'm crazy. Yeah.
Ah, there we go. I guess, you know, there are still certain things that are better done in private. So yes. But for me, what was really most extraordinary about that was just to see his, you know, for me, it was just the absolute verification that besides all of his other, you know, manifestations of wisdom and compassion, that there was just an incredible sort of intuitive grasp of what's appropriate, for people individually. Because I'm sure what he advised me to do and was not something that necessarily would have been something he would have advised for everyone.
Right. But it involved allowing yourself to embody what maybe Carl Jung would refer to as shadow kind of aspects of the self, in order to move through them and integrate them, would you say?
I would say that's a very, very good analogy. I think, you know, with Carl Jung's sense, of archetypes, that we have these collective, universal, psychic, archetypes really is the best word, that we invoke, or that we experience, that, you know, as Jung said, if we don't bring them into our conscious attention, then they live themselves through us unconsciously, and in that respect can get us into lots of trouble. So in this case, yes, it's very much working with a kind of conscious shadow work, in the sense that those parts of the psyche that are often suppressed just because they're chaotic or they're difficult to deal with or reconcile or explain are brought into conscious play through very, very specific sets of practices. So very much, I think, what I engaged with on that particular month retreat was work that allowed those shadow aspects of the psyche to fully emerge, and therefore to be processed, and therefore not to have the kind of subconscious hold that some of these archetypes can have on us if we don't bring them into conscious awareness.
Yeah. In a sense, knowing their name and
having
power over them.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Now there's a Tibetan, forgive me, what was the title, Tibetan Healing?
A book that I wrote. Well, it was called "The Art of
Tibetan Healing." Can you tell us a little? I have to admit, I haven't read that book. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis? I'm very fascinated. I intend to read it.
Good. Me too. Well, the book is an introductory book that accompanies details from a set of 17th century Tibetan scroll paintings that illustrate the Tibetan medical tantras. Mm. So Tibetan medicine is a very unique system of medicine in that it integrates Indian Ayurveda, Chinese traditional medicine, and indigenous Tibetan Bun, you could say almost shamanistic medicine. And it brings these together into kind of a new synthesis that's very, very dynamic and powerful and works with, you know, an incredible range of pharmacopoeia, as well as other practices. And so the book is essentially works with this set of 79 paintings that were created to serve as, you could say, as visual guides for Tibetan doctors in training at that time. Mm. And so the book I wrote was to kind of try to bring the essence of the Tibetan medical training into a more accessible form through the way that I presented these and details from each of the scroll paintings. So it was a great journey that also brought me over a period of a year or so to many, many of the greatest Tibetan healers today, and to experience and these different modalities with which they work. So it was a great project in that, you know, that I embraced in a way very experientially. And at the same time, the art alone of these paintings is extraordinary, because not only is it illustrating healing and medical techniques from Tibet, but it's also showing fantastically interesting vignettes of everyday life from 17th century Tibet that you don't otherwise see, because the rest, for the most part, Tibetan art is all focused on Buddhism, and as a result, these kind of just scenes from everyday life are less apparent.
Amazing. And Ian, how much would you say you had to, I guess, modernize the traditional forms of healing to be used and practiced and accepted in our current mm-hmm. culture? Because I know, you know, some certain techniques of Ayurveda that are still practiced may not be as accessible or accepted mm-hmm. in kind of the modern Western culture.
Yeah, well, I think one of the probably more controversial aspects of both Ayurvedic medicine and Tibetan medicine is the use of mercury, for example, as a therapeutic agent. So yeah. It's, of course, the toxic effects of mercury are very well known in both traditions. And, you know, actually one of the four great medical treatises of Tibet, which are called the Gyushi, or the four medical tantras, one of them starts out with the sentence saying mercury is the greatest poison and it's also the greatest medicine if you know how to use it properly. So so contextualizing mercury was a challenge, just mm-hmm. because, you know, it is obviously in its unrefined form a potent neurotoxin. And yet it did sort of, I was quite fascinated with this idea that the tradition was consciously aware of its dangers, and yet nonetheless subscribed to using it in what they would call purified form for longevity and powers. And so I researched that quite extensively, both within the Tibetan medical tradition and later among alchemist wizards in Burma, where there's a very, very strong continuing practice of mercury-based alchemy in remote monasteries in Burma, which was a fascinating project. So I would say, and so this way of trying to understand the role of mercury in not just in medicine and meditation is something that's still very, very of great interest to me, and something that to some degree I'm working on currently in Burma. But just to go back to the Tibetan tradition, because you're asking if there were, you know, otherwise it's the other traditions of Tibetan medicine are quite straightforward. They can be understood within the context of both traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda. I mean, some of them are, of course, very strong. They have powerful reactions. But, you know, for example, I'd had a very bad rock climbing accident when I was young, when I was 22. And trying to sort of heal the residual effects of that were something that I was an ongoing quest. And one of the big, huge breakthroughs for that was actually having a golden needle sunk into the top of my skull and having a mugwort mixture lit on top of it, all of which I didn't feel for a moment. And then all of a sudden it was by a Tibetan, senior Tibetan doctor. And it just sort of, it was suddenly like having a spear just sort of sent down through your spinal column and right down to the core. Amazingly powerful reaction, which actually relieved a lot of the residual trauma that I'd had from that accident. So again, some of the effects are, some of the techniques are what we would consider from a Western point of view, very invasive. Actually no more invasive than surgery is for that matter, but done without anesthetic can feel more invasive, and yet has, at least certainly in my case, in this instance, you know, very, very powerful remedial effect. So, I think a quite fascinating tradition and very, very rich in that it combines medicine, meditation, and draws from, you know, a variety of traditions to try to come up with a true mind-body medicine.
How often or how much would you say that you integrate this in your current life?
Good. I was just in London. I'm up in Scotland now, in the Highlands where I'm based, but I was just in London until a couple of days ago, and I actually met with a Tibetan doctor there who I know, and picked up my latest little bag of herbal formula called Wangchen, because, you know, they're just wonderful substances. I like using them. I like the taste of them. And there are some that are just, which are called, the ones I got are called chulen, which means basically extracted essences. So they function in a certain sense like an herbal tonic, so that you don't, it's not that they're treating any specific illness of any kind, but they can just be taken as a general restorative for the body and the mind together. So in that sense, yes, when the opportunity arises, I'll stock up.
So do you have any projects that you're working on currently or anything that we can look forward to seeing pop up on Amazon?
Yeah, well, I'm finishing a long overdue book that's called Tibetan Yoga, Secrets from the Source. And yes, that will be, I've been working on it for years, and it's very, and it got basically waylaid because of this big exhibition that I did in London last year called Tibet's Secret Temple that basically took 3 years to prepare for. And I'll just kind of back up a minute and say that exhibition was about representing a set of 17th century murals in what had been the private meditation chamber for Tibet's sixth Dalai Lama. Mm. And essentially the murals serve as a visual guide of the path to enlightenment in it from the non-monastic yogic tradition. So a very, very powerful set of what were once secret murals. And we presented them in London at this exhibition, along with about 115 other objects to kind of contextualize tantric Buddhism and concepts of mind, body, and meditation. So this book, which I'm doing, was essentially doing the same thing, except that I wasn't able to just finish it because of all the obligations that I had at that time. Mm-hmm. But I am now, and that book will be looking in greater depth at what these practices are, which are essentially the six yogas, as they're often referred to, the six yogas of Naropa or Nyingma. They're a set of practices that can be done at different stages of waking, dreaming, sleeping, even dying, in order to awaken the Buddha nature, the depth consciousness, that, you know, that aspect of awareness that goes beyond thoughts and emotions and self-identification. But also deals very, very deeply with the light meditations associated with Dzogchen, or the great perfection tradition of Tibet. So the book will be heavily illustrated, because for years and years I've been kind of documenting very, very, not only wall paintings in Tibet, but also practitioners in very remote parts of the Himalayas, and who have been willing to share some of these otherwise esoteric secret traditions, and the reason I feel that this is appropriate is it was very much the Dalai Lama's own request of me when I did my first book called The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple, when I had shown him images of this temple in Tibet that his predecessor had actually meditated in. And before I even had said anything, he said, please make a book about these. And I said, well, aren't these secret practices? And he said, time of secrecy is over. He said, when these things remain secret, they'll just remain misunderstood. So please, you know, do your best and reveal fully what these practices are about, because he said these practices are very, very relevant, especially, he said, for the Western world, because they are from a non-monastic perspective, and therefore they're about integrating with everyday life. They are, in that sense, the epitomes of the tantric tradition, which, as you know, was a way of embracing life and not renouncing the human condition, but actually transforming it through a fully embracing all aspects of our humanity. And so that's what this book will be about. And I'm also engaged now with a new exhibition that will be launched in London in 2020 at a very, very major museum, which I can't mention yet. But it will be public knowledge soon. Nice. And that's going to be extremely exciting, because it's really going to be looking at the experiential side of tantric Buddhist art, and how these images and icons and archetypes were all about ways of inducing certain states of awareness, states of consciousness, and for transforming the human condition in the largest sense. So this will be an exhibition really about the dialogue between science and tantric Buddhism, as well as, you could say, the latest technologies, in order to show how we can actually shift consciousness from into much larger and expansive states of awareness that become beneficial not just individually but for society as a whole.
I've seen some of those tests where they measure the brain waves of monks that have been meditating all their lives, and when they're in meditative states. And I mean, I don't know enough about brain waves to be as impressed as the scientists seem to be. But
yeah, well, to be honest, I think there's scientists who I'm working with now, neuroscientists, who say, well, you know the in some ways, the brain scans are very misleading, because they actually are still icons of our very head-centric Western approach to things.
True.
Because as we know, there are just as many neurons in the heart and in the viscera, the gut, than there are in the brain. And so by only doing brain scans and in a certain sense ignoring entirely what's happening in the heart and the gut,
the experiential aspect of it. Yeah, rather than just learning to meditate, they're looking at the brain scans of a monk.
And as one neuroscientist recently told me, he said, well, this looks so impressive, this state of, what in a way is imaged here in a state of deep meditation. But she said, honestly, you get the same image if you just prick somebody suddenly with a pin. So that sort of puts a lot of this in perspective. You know, basically, it's showing that the brain, in a state of sudden, you could say, shock, goes into kind of a defense mode that can light up the brain in very impressive ways.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, in other words, we shouldn't be entirely misled by these pretty mandalas of the brain, as it were.
But then that makes me think of some of those traditions with the the meditative states where they're bringing deities into play with music and banging drums and blowing through trumpets made from human bones and things like that. And it explores a lot more than just kind of like what people often think of when they think of Buddhism is like more the Zen Buddhism, where it's just silence, a rock garden, So this, for people grounded in that, sometimes you start, well, not you, but sometimes I'll start talking about tantric Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and they just say, oh, well, that's just a bunch of, that's not even Buddhism, that's just a mixture of a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, well, I think those kind of perspectives tend to, be subconsciously conditioned by our own sort of Western Christian inheritance and puritanical views of what religion is supposed to
be. But looking at the Catholics. Yeah,
basically it's a kind of covert Catholicism masquerading as Buddhism, because, I mean, the beauty in a way of tantric Buddhism was its full embrace of, to some degree, the very same things that Siddhartha Gautama, before he became Buddha, renounced. But basically you know, he'd been through the whole drama of the passions, you know, found another way. But I think this was really the beauty of the tantric revolution, if one wants to call it that, within Buddhism, is it made Buddhism relevant in ways that it hadn't been outside of monastic communities, which had, by their own accounts, often fallen into a kind of sterile scholasticism by the 6th and 7th centuries in the time that the tantric Buddhist texts first began to appear. And they were radical texts, and they were often vehemently rejected by Buddhist monastic communities, and only gradually over centuries did, in some ways, they become reintegrated into monastic Buddhism. But more importantly, they were expansions of the wisdom and compassion at the foundation of Buddhism, but applying it as a literally as a method, as the lightning method, of the thunder path, which is in a certain sense what Vajrayana, the diamond path, really refers to. These were ways of accelerating transformation, liberation, and power, rather than, as the conventional Buddhist tradition says, after many, many lifetimes, if you're lucky, you might, you know, might attain enlightenment. But the Buddhist, you know, the tantric approach was, well, why wait? Why not, you know, take the result as the path, as it were, and presents things in that way. And as long as, you know, as the Dalai Lama himself has said, you know, when motivated by compassion and altruistic ethical orientation, then, you know, it is. It's such an incredible embrace of all of life and of, you know, of the shadows and the light, to use the, you know, the Jungian sense, and bring about that union of opposites that, in a certain sense, we would have to say is, on a relative level, you know, what Jung referred to as the individuation process, and would, in Buddhism, be a process of liberation.
Fascinating.
I just wanted to say thank you for being you. And
yeah, this is, I love all of this.
Yeah, you're so special and such a light, and, you know, transmitting and communicating and just delivering in a creative way all of the sacred knowledge and wisdom to the mainstream is beautiful and special. And it takes so much courage for you to be able to, you know, just surrender and be open to, you know, trying this. There's so much courage and obedience, I guess, to something outside of
and,
you.
Yeah, an inspiration.
Yeah. So thank you.
Well, no, my pleasure. And I was very, you know, very grateful to be able to participate in your, you know, wonderful series of podcasts that really, I think, are tapping into, as we know, the esoteric is always, of course, that which is most essential.
Well, thank you.
And yet it's the underground current that keeps life going.
Yeah.
So as I said, I'll be looking forward to even paying more attention. And
we're starting up another podcast soon called "What Would Yeshi Do?" So in light of that, I don't know. I guess that's the question: what would Yeshi do? Like, looking at the world as it is today, you know, kind of going to work, running to keep up, driving to work. You know, in this world, in this Western world. Like, what would that look like if somebody became awakened to these mysteries in the West? I mean, I'm sure it'd be individuated, like not everyone would look the same, but do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it's very interesting that you actually mention it, because we're actually, I'm going to Tibet next month, and I'll be there for about 6 weeks, and I'm going to Mount Kailash in particular in Western Tibet, because we're making a film there about this mountain at the center of the world, which, as you know, for Buddhists and Hindus represents, in a certain sense, the axis mundi of the planet. But we're also doing a film based upon footage that I have from years ago of an extraordinary Tibetan yogini who lives just below the cave where Yeshe Tsogyal attained enlightenment practicing the secret yogas of inner heat in the 8th century. And so part of that film project, which we're actually just going to make an initial trailer about from previous footage in the hopes to actually raise funds to do a more full film, is actually, in a certain funny way, exactly as about what you're saying. These are yoginis who live in the beneath the cave of where Yashisoga attained enlightenment. And the question that the film will be asking is, you know, how are they expressing Yashisoga's own aspirations in their lives today? And what do they see as the trajectory of those practices in the contemporary world? So I think it's an incredibly important story that you're asking, what would Yeshe do? Because she was such an extraordinary being. I always thought that her life story would make an incredible sort of Hollywood feature film, you know, about a young and beautiful Tibetan princess who's given away to some, you know,
not Scarlett Johansson, please.
No, we gotta find out. But yeah, basically to the, you know, the tantric sage from India who probably at that time didn't speak any Tibetan. And then, you know, gets whisked off into the ice caves to practice esoteric tantric practices, and goes off afterwards into incredible adventures across the Himalayas with her consorts in Nepal, and, you know, an incredible story. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, her life, the challenges that she went through in her life, which are extraordinary, and which are in some ways reflected by these nuns who are practicing in her tradition today, you know, is something I think of enormous interest. So I'll be very interested to hear more about what you're doing with that, and to see, you know, if it goes to farther, to look at possible collaborative ways of bringing that story into kind of a filmic form that, you know, really asks that question on a larger level.
Yeah. Oh, and I would love if you were to be able to refer, you know, anyone who might be interested in coming on here and talking a little bit about that question, who mm-hmm. might be involved with that, or, you know.
Sure, I can do that, because there are certainly people, I'm sure you know many, but there are, of course, many women I know in the States who are very much following in the tradition of Yashisogyal and would, I'm sure, be very happy to share some of their perspectives. The other person I'm thinking of is, she's literally an extraordinary woman, a Bhutanese yogini, and probably only in her mid-30s now, who is coming out of a two consecutive three-year meditation retreats in Bhutan, wow. In which she would refuse to cut her hair and become a nun from her teachers, one of the great, great, you know, lamas of Bhutan, because she said, my role model is Yashisogyal. And she practiced tantra. She did not renounce the world. She basically embraced it fully. Wow. So she comes literally out next week from her second three-year solitary retreat. So she would be, her English is actually very good, but she has such an amazing voice. I mean, I'm not sure that she would be willing to, in a sense, expose herself yet.
but she would be a fascinating person to meet without recording it.
Fascinating person. And as I said, a very, very close friend of mine. So I'll bridge the subject.
Thank you.
With her. Because it would be really from someone who's just dedicated their life to following the example of Yashisogyal on every
perfect.
Level.
Yeah, that's exactly what the voice that we feel called to help amplify. Out of curiosity, what languages have you learned?
I speak I speak Tibetan and Nepalese, in terms of Asian languages, that's really all. And then some smattering of European languages like Norwegian, but that's
I'm sure definitely helps with interviewing people and getting to know people, because probably
having the local languages was enormously important for my access to these traditions.
Would you say they're difficult languages?
Nepalese is fairly straightforward. Tibetan, more difficult, but okay. I don't think either of them are particular anywhere as difficult as, let's say, certain other
Mandarin.
Japanese, or where it would be much more difficult. For sure. So they're in the realm of possibility. Definitely.
My growing up, my dad and I were always driving around the mountains here, the Angeles Crest Mountains, and he was looking for the Beul here.
Ah.
We were always pulling over and he was like being magnetically drawn to an area. And then he'd say, this is a power spot here. Or he'd hear about one from someone else. So we were always going and meditating in power spots and focusing on our third eye and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to going to the actual Bayul.
Well, the Bayul are everywhere.
That was the idea, is that you don't have to go to Tibet.
Where are you located?
Los Angeles.
Oh, in Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so we just go up to the Angeles Crest Mountains up here, drive around, and there are some powerful spots, you know, and, you know, weird clearings where it's like, why aren't there any trees in this circle? You know, probably because there were native, you know, tribes that were practicing in that spot for who knows how many centuries, you know, and so it's interesting.
No, well, there's tremendous amount of thing, you know, a lot going out there. I'm actually supposed to go to L.A. soon. I mean, it's funny. I just got an email yesterday because of another film project, which I didn't mention, on Tibetan, on Tantric Buddhist art, which I'm involved with. They may need to have me come to L.A. soon. So we'll see what happens.
What's the name of that one?
It's got a working title, Mandala, but it may change. But it will be partly filmed in Tibet and elsewhere, but kind of going in deeply into the world of tantric art and how it invokes experiences, and in a certain sense that we embody the art in that respect. So we'll see where that all goes. Really, it was a pleasure to participate in your
likewise. Thank you so much for coming on here.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you, both of you, and look forward to being in touch. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian Baker, for being our guest on this debut episode of the What Would Yes You Do podcast. And thank you also to Yoga in the Park, Los Angeles.
The Yoga in the Park fundraiser is coming up Saturday, June 17th, 9 a.m. to noon at Pan Pacific Park on the lawn at the corner of Beverly and Gardner. All proceeds presented to the Best in Drag show, and all info can be found at yogainthepark.la.org.
Thank you all for tuning in. Good night.